We're talking about a world without borders today. And the foundational story of America is that everyone wants to come here. That's what the Statue of Liberty stands for, right? This idea that for centuries we took in the world's poor and tired and huddled masses, people who came here and found a better life. Well, it turns out that history is kind of wrong. Tara Zara is a historian at the University of Chicago. She's one of those MacArthur Genius Award winners. And she studies the history of immigration in the 19th and early 20th centuries, specifically the period when hundreds of thousands of people from Eastern Europe were streaming into the U.S. And Tara told Raymond Tangekar that the story we tell about immigration looks really different when you tell it from the perspective of the people and the countries who were left back home.
What I was really interested in was the impact of this mass migration on the societies that people were leaving behind. And I like to think about the impact both in terms of the big scale issues, but also at a very local scale. What does it mean for that many parents to lose their children, or for wives to lose their husbands? Governments had a whole different set of concerns that animated this anti-immigration movement that I track. And there it had a lot to do with the perceived losses to the state that emigration brought with it. The loss of military power, for example, that suddenly conscripts didn't show up because they'd all run off to America, the loss of labor power, the need to pay workers more, for example, because suddenly you're competing in a global labor market. Religious authorities were really concerned about peasants going off to American cities and becoming demoralized and secularized in America. So there were fears about the moral and religious consequences. And in general, at the time, emigration was kind of largely seen as a loss to the state, that the state had invested in educating and providing for these citizens who then went off in their most productive years and contributed to the growth of another society or another state.
Well, and throughout the book, you rely on, you know, letters and court documents and other archival materials to kind of illustrate this, the idea that this was not looked favorably in Europe. Could you go into some of that? Like, what were the kinds of things that people were writing?
There were huge numbers of things going on. I mean, for one thing that it's important to think about is that at the time, the social security and welfare system in Europe was already much more developed than it was in the United States. So what a lot of people were talking about was the fact that, sure, if you go to Chicago or Detroit, you might earn a little bit more, but at what cost? Wealth isn't everything. And people started to think about the sort of human costs of this mass migration, that they were working long hours, that they were separated from their family and friends, that if they got in an accident, got hurt on the job, or got sick, there was very little support system in place to help them out. So a lot of the letters would say things like, America is great as long as you're healthy, but if you get sick, it's no place to be.
Well, there was a shocking statistic that you list in the book, and it kind of blew my mind. You say that 30 to 40% of European immigrants actually ultimately went back to their home countries?
That's right. And in some cases, that was really always the plan. And I think that's still true with a lot of immigration today, that people intended to come to the United States for 3 or 4 years, work as hard as possible, save as much as possible, and then go home to improve their situations there.
I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, if there's such ambivalence about life in America, why is there such cultural amnesia about this period? Why don't we actually see this as kind of a really complicated, complex time to be a migrant in America?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, on the one hand, if you look closely, we have lots of memoirs and fiction and documentary evidence that does illustrate precisely the point that, you know, conditions in the tenements of New York were really horrible. On the other hand, Americans are the descendants of the people who stayed in general. So for one, you know, we don't have as much of the voices of those who went home as part of our, you know, our own public culture here. I think that's a huge part of it. I think also, you know, and this is really a positive thing in some way, that immigration, you know, at times it's always been a controversial issue and remains one, but it is part of America's idea of who we are.
Hearing you talk makes it sound like the U.S. had something. It almost sounds like it was an open border policy. I mean, that's probably an oversimplification, but it seemed much looser than it is now. And I guess I'm wondering when that changed, when the U.S. started to tighten its restrictions on its borders.
Until 1921 and then really 1924, I would say that the borders to the United States were relatively open for Europeans. For example, at Ellis Island, only around 1-2% of people were actually rejected. And otherwise, it was pretty easy to come to the United States and to come and go. That's the other thing. So this period in which 30-40% returned, that was partly because it was very easy to go home and then come back again. So people didn't have the fear that if they left, they would never be able to return. That all changed in 1924 with the introduction of the Quota Act, or the Johnson-Reed Act, which massively restricted immigration to the United States and introduced this system of racial or ethnic quotas, and particularly was aimed at suppressing migration from Southern and Eastern Europe.
And what was the underlying logic behind shifting to the quota system and restricting immigration in and out of the country?
Well, there were a lot of anti-immigration forces then, just as there are today. There were people concerned about protecting American jobs and so on and so forth. But I would say a lot of the concern was purely racist. It was about fears of racial degeneration. And at the time, East Europeans and Italians, Southern Europeans, were seen really as non-white people. So the goal of the Quota Act was to essentially freeze the demographics of the American population to what it had been in the early 19th century. So it privileged migrants from Northern Europe and from Germany and discriminated against those from Eastern and Southern Europe who were seen as less desirable, mostly on racial grounds.
So you've written this wonderful history book, but it's obviously a very timely subject. How has working on this book shaped your view on migration today?
I think it's fascinating how many of the same discussions and fears have played out. For example, in the early 20th century and then again in the 1950s, a lot of refugees coming from dictatorships, from Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, and then from communist regimes after the Second World War, were suspected of being spies or, you know, threatening politically, even though they were actually running away from these oppressive governments. And that was, you know, a constant force behind efforts to curb the admission of refugees. And you see the very same arguments today in the discussion of admitting refugees from Syria, for example. So that's really striking to me. But, you know, the other thing that I think is kind of interesting to think about in this story in terms of the current refugee crisis is that these countries that produce the vast majority of migrants throughout the 20th century are now, if you look at what's going on in Europe, often the most hostile to immigration, right? So Poland, mm-hmm. Hungary, even the Czech Republic and Slovakia have been extremely reluctant, even by your, you know, global standards, to admit refugees. And that seems, I think, at first like a contradiction. But I think that this longer history of ambivalence about mass migration helps us to understand that animosity toward immigration today.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about this period, I think the conventional story, at least among a lot of Americans, is that Europeans moved to the U.S. in order to seek economic prosperity and freedom. I'm wondering, though, if this period of mass migration, if that in any way has actually shaped America's understanding of what it means to be free.
I think so. I mean, I think in the United States, in part due to this mass migration, but also you could think about other factors like the history of slavery in the United States or the history of the frontier. We have a strong association between movement and freedom, between mobility and freedom. But what you can see if you look at this debate from a transatlantic perspective is that there are also other ideas of what it means to be free. So there was always a debate here, and that in Eastern Europe, what a lot of government officials, but also ordinary people were saying is that Real freedom is the freedom to be able to stay home and live in peace and security. And there are echoes of that sentiment today as well. There's, for example, a right to stay movement that makes precisely those kinds of arguments that in an ideal world, there would be no mass migration. And that's an interesting thing to think about.
That's the historian Tara Zara talking with Raymond Tankekar. Tara is the author of The Great Departure, Mass Migration from Eastern Europe and the Making of the Free World.